The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hi, this is Jerry Boyer. Welcome to this edition of Meeting of Minds. My guest today is Jonathan Barry. Jonathan's the managing partner of the highly prestigious D.C. law firm and public affairs firm Boyden Gray. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Jerry, thanks so much for having me.
I watched your testimony before Congress recently, the committee that was looking specifically at the question of ESG, and even more specifically at the issue of the proxy process and proxy voting. And I just thought it was just a wonderful introduction to an area that's really obscure for so many people, but is incredibly important in driving the politicization of corporations that we see now and are concerned about. And I just think one person in a thousand who's concerned about the direction of corporations understands the mechanism and the system that's pointing the corporations in that wrong direction. So if you could just kind of give us that beginner's level intro to the proxy process that you gave for Congress and kind of include us in it, and then we can kind of go on and talk about some of the more advanced topics and then how to improve things.
Absolutely. So our public companies in America, they're publicly traded on stock exchanges. They issue stock. Stockholders own that, usually with the ownership of a certain amount of stock, and sometimes it can be shockingly little, just $2,000 relative to multi-billion dollars in the value of the overall company. A shareholder can propose some kind of resolution about something that the company ought to do or ought to take a stand on. And this is increasingly one of the favored vehicles by which the political left, ESG activists, will use to try to pressure corporate behavior away from the core focus of excellence in the creation and provision of goods and services that they do, and drive that more towards a narrower political agenda. This is common proposal topics are going to be on climate change. They may be on diversity. They may be on LGBT issues or abortion. Has gotten some greater popularity as a proposal topic after Dobbs restored the ability of states to protect human life. So they'll introduce these proposals, and after some review from the Securities and Exchange Commission, the federal regulator, they'll get onto the shareholder ballot. Kind of like if you're in a state that has direct democracy, you may be voting on ballot initiatives for one thing or another.
Like initiative and referendum, but for corporations. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Right. What happens once a proposal gets on the ballot many days in advance of the actual vote, that's when the big financial players tend to really activate and have pushed things, push some of these proposals across the finish line. So this is where big asset managers like BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street, or the proxy advisors as well, can really swing a lot of votes in favor of one or other of these sometimes very political proposals.
I see. So it's an interesting point that you made sort of toward the beginning. It doesn't take a lot to do this. So you think about Apple Corporation has a market cap of about $3 trillion. If you've owned $2,000 worth of Apple for 3 years, which I'm kind of like trying to do the decimal points in my head here, forgive me if I've gotten them wrong, that's less than a billionth of the value of the company. So it is two-thirds of a billionth, of the value of the company. You have the ability to command the attention of the entire board of directors, upper management, and all other shareholders attending the meeting, including shareholders who might own billions of dollars, you know, worth of this corporation. You can, in essence, with your $2,000, you can get your slice of the stage.
Yes.
To make your speech that Apple should censor conservative content more, for example, or Apple should track people who are talking about guns, even if they're doing it legally, or whatever is your social issue, or Apple should have this quota for, you know, for race at the board level, et cetera. In essence, you're kind of like grabbing the microphone with an infinitesimally small amount of shareholder capital. I mean, it's almost like a rent-seeking kind of thing, and you start to steer the conversation in your direction, even though you're not even close to them. None of these are even close to these cutoffs for how much you have to own or even close to
yes.
materiality for any company, really, frankly, other than a penny stock company.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, yet you can steer the conversation. Right. You can grab the conversation and steer it.
And yeah, I think the analogy, Jerry, is with, you know, we have a whole, like in our federal government, we have this whole system by which people vote on representatives, and those representatives in turn deliberate about, okay, what's the political agenda going to be? Like there's a real critical mass that needs to happen before any bill, any proposal for what our federal government ought to do is going to get consideration. The equivalent would be, I guess, if any resident in the country was able to introduce a bill into Congress or something like that. That's not how we're set up as a republic. Mm-hmm. And it's an odd disjoint with how public corporations
and give a speech. So imagine someone just kind of rushing into Congress and rushing forward. I want to give a speech. I'm introducing a bill. Say at Starbucks, I don't think you should sell milk anymore. Yes, that basically was a proposal. It was change your pricing to subsidize oat milk so people won't buy milk. So I don't know. It seems to me like a coffee company ought to have dairy products in the mix. But
I think so.
One would think it's like coffee, but no cream. Cream's bad. That was a PETA, people for the ethical treatment. So you rush into Congress and you grab the microphone and someone calls for the sergeant of arms. And instead, the Securities Exchange Commission comes in and says, no. You know, they give them their 3 minutes, and that's what's happened for something like 30 or 40 years. People at the fringe of American politics have like figured out that they can game the system this way and command attention with immaterial amounts of stock. And I think under some of the new rules, it's even easier now. And maybe that's something you can talk about under the Biden administration new rules. It's considerably easier to get political proposals on these ballots rather than things that are directly relevant to business.
Yeah, that's right. You have now this administration has put new guidance in place saying that if a proposal raises a significant social policy question, the SEC is never going to come in essence and block that proposal from disapprove that proposal from getting on the ballot, even if like it still relates to the ordinary business operations of the company. And the real the real problem, Jerry, and we've argued this in litigation we're leading, and I know you're familiar with this too, is that it's unelected SEC bureaucrats who are deciding what is what counts as significant social policy. And wouldn't you know it, there's maybe a discernible political bias to the way they decide this.
Yes, apparently they think some things are significant social policies and other things aren't. Like, for instance, when conservatives are concerned about politics in the boardroom and the effect on the brand, I was involved with some proposals that were knocked down by the SEC on these topics. And yes. Yet animal welfare, again, I bring it up because it's just such a silly example, you know. Cream in the coffee. You can't have cream in the coffee because it's bad for the animals. That's of significant social policy, a significant social interest. So, I mean, they obviously have their biases.
It's so bad. We have the central comparison in our live lawsuit in the federal appellate court in Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, is comparing a proposal that got in. Put forward by a left-wing proponent on sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination.
Right.
The SEC staff said, okay, this is a significant social question, and so we're not going to let the company keep it off the ballot. It's got to go on the shareholder ballot. But when our client, the National Center for Public Policy Research, submitted a proposal on that was verbatim identical, except they swapped in viewpoint and ideology for sexual orientation and gender identity, the SEC said, no, that's not a significant social policy. This despite the fact that the question of cancel culture and people suffering viewpoint discrimination in the workplace, like pressure on their jobs and their livelihoods for their political views, for their worldviews, that's a hot topic, Jerry. I don't know what world that's where that's not significant.
Well, but see, that's a very interesting point. What world? Mm-hmm. So I remember having a conversation with somebody from one of the proxy advisory services. I won't say who because it's off the record. So it's just speaking mm-hmm. for the class, where the issue was the taking down of content from a social media provider, and a conservative proponent wanted the company to come forward and say, these are times when we've taken down content in response to conversations with the government. And the rationale against the proposal was that it wasn't a matter of significant public controversy or not a matter of reputational risk. And my question was, really? You don't know anybody who gripes about YouTube demonetizing conservatives?
Right.
Because I know I see it all the time. So in conservative world, we're really concerned about this. So I think in good faith, someone could say, oh, it's not really a significant concern because they don't, it's the Pauline Kael standard.
Oh, you got to it first. I was totally going to quote her.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
All right, go ahead. I mean, I set you up. Who is Pauline Kael, Jonathan?
So she was, I want to say she was the movie critic for Time Magazine. Washington Post. Oh. And she said something to the effect of, like, how did Richard Nixon win? No one I know voted for him. and just like, yeah, whoa, I don't know what to tell you.
So nobody they knew, you know, understood that conservatives were definitely feeling like there was a differential in treatment when it comes to edgy content So you just want to soapbox this for a moment. All the more reason for conservatives to be talking into this system.
Yes.
I mean, yes, SEC's biased. Yes, there are all these structural problems. But on the other hand, we can befriend, we can have conversations, we can say, by the way, here's a viral video from Dennis Prager, who is talking about how he was demonetized and the effect that it had on his livelihood, and a lot of and he is a nationally syndicated talk show host, and he's talked about this a lot. So it definitely is an issue in some circles. Just to kind of, maybe you don't know any people like that. I understand. You're in Rockville or whatever. But let me tell you, you know, outside, these are things people are talking about, and then they can decide to take them into account. So in this case, National Center basically had exactly the same language, except viewpoint diversity rather than gender identity diversity. And
that's right.
One was knocked down and the other isn't. And you've got a lawsuit on that right now.
Yes, that's right. So we filed suit against the SEC on their biased viewpoint discrimination against our client on that, and then just really their larger pattern of viewpoint discrimination against shareholder proposals that don't meet with the SEC staff's political proclivities. It seems that's in front of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals right now in the South.
Got it. So this could end up trimming back the SEC's power in very meaningful ways. I mean, I think you make a very, very strong case in your testimony, both verbal and written, that it was never the intention of the framers of American corporate law to give this power to the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Yeah, that's right. We argue that there is, and I think it's just true, that there is a lot of evidence that when the federal government gets into the business of securities regulation in a big way in the 30s, they were really trying to ensure accuracy in the disclosures and the information that was going to be circulated about securities, but it wasn't trying to displace the role of the states in setting up corporate law, in setting up those relationships between shareholders and corporate directors and officers, what those responsibilities look like. There was supposed to be a lot of space for experimentation there, and in some ways there still is. But here, the SEC, for quite some time now, has basically stepped in and said, we are going to decide when a shareholder proposal gets on the ballot or doesn't get on the ballot.
That would be true even if they weren't biased. Right,
that's right. Yeah, that's right. That is a structural issue that you can make distinct from the viewpoint bias.
So in some sense, there's two problems. One is they seem to have given themselves an authority which no legislative body has given them, and the other is they seem to be using it in a way which is itself discriminatory as to viewpoint. So they're not even using their usurped authority. Well, I mean, one might almost look the other way and say, well, they're doing okay, even though this isn't their job. But they're not. They don't seem to be doing okay. Although, are they doing a little better? I wonder if lawsuits like yours, or even the possibility of lawsuits like yours, have gotten their attention. There were a few proposals that got through last year, some of which we were involved with. Which it kind of surprised me a little bit, given the history of bias, and I wonder if they're kind of like on best behavior a bit. Don't take away this. You know, a lot of people depend on these. You know, we got a lot of jobs here. You know, here at the SEC, where staff members are making these calls, so maybe they're trying to kind of duck under the radar screen and be more fair. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's. You know, I don't know what's happening in this particular case. We've definitely seen it be the case that sometimes you have an administrative agency that's getting over its skis, they're acting in a way they shouldn't be. And when they start to see a threat of a real response, they may even temporarily try to dial it down and just hope things blow over so they can get back to the fun work of, just your viewpoint bias or whatever it is.
Right, right. So the idea here is that if the law were being followed properly, this would almost certainly go back to the states. Where shareholders would not be silenced, states would very likely have accommodations for shareholders, but there would be standards of materiality likely or relevance to, you know, the proper conduct of business. In other words, I'm not sure Delaware would say, sure, you're a pro-abortion activist and you can find some strained rationale that somehow this is a business problem to do business in these states because women will have to, I guess they have to leave the cubicle and go home, to have babies, even though these states are the states where population is growing, not shrinking for the most part. And people are fleeing from New York, for example, to go to these states that you think there's going to be a dearth of. I mean, the argument is ludicrous, but you found some strained rationale. I can't imagine that a kind of business-friendly state like Delaware is going to say, sure, bring it all. If it's a social concern, then yeah, you can do your op-ed on company time and command the attention of all the other shareholders if you own 2/3 of a billionth of the company. But I don't think it would be a complete shutout for the most case. I think that there probably is some intent in the law to have, what's that phrase, shareholder suffrage, that shareholders should be heard, but they should be heard when they're relevant.
see
what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. And there's a lot of the state law, in this space has been, it's formed or not formed under the shadow of the SEC asserting authority here for a very long time. But the fact remains that I think it's fair to say, generally speaking, that states will authorize, state corporate law will authorize a shareholder proposal when it's a proper subject under state law for the business of the annual meeting of the corporation. And then let's also not forget that really in many ways the core right, suffrage right that a shareholder typically enjoys under state law is the election or deposition of directors. Like think in terms of like Republican democracy, of indirect democracy, just as we have of almost all policymaking except for ballot initiatives and the like, happens this way throughout the United States, both the federal and state and most local levels.
Right. Yeah. Corporations are basically a parliamentary system, right? You elect the board is essentially equivalent to a legislative body, and then they choose a prime minister. I mean, it's probably more like that than it is the American system.
You don't have a separate, there's not an electorate who's separately electing the chief executive, right?
Right, and I also thought about this after reading your testimony. Before the vote for the board, there is one extremely important vote, which is the vote with your dollar to invest in the company. Mm-hmm. In other words, your main vote for or against a company is to invest in it or not. So if you're invested in a company in a material way, rather than you buy $2,500 worth so that it probably won't dip below $2,000, and then you hold it for 3 years so you can do an activist routine. So, I mean, so people who buy like, or they buy one share so they can go to the annual meeting. Because, by the way, that's part of it. We can be one share.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then there you are at the microphone screaming about space lasers or whatever you want, you know. The main way you express confidence in a company and its management is to invest in it. And there should be a certain amount of confidence in it. Otherwise, why are you investing in the company unless you're just a pure political activist? As opposed to there's something else. There are shareholder activists who don't have confidence in the company. They buy with the intent to get enough shares to kick management out. And that's a different thing entirely. But that there's still skin in the game in some sense, as opposed to political activists who don't really have skin in the game.
Yes. Yeah. That's right. Now there's a big difference there.
Yeah, voice in the game, but not skin in the game, I guess is the. Okay. So mm-hmm. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, I think this is the last thing we'll ask about for this conversation. Although I think we might have you back in the near future to talk about another important issue that's brewing. But we recently had a ruling from the Supreme Court of the United States really dealing with two cases at the same time about higher education. Harvard is the more high profile of the two institutions, which in essence was a pretty strong rebuff to the idea of quotas based on race, which seemed to be de facto instances of reverse discrimination. In the case of Harvard, I think it's essentially discrimination against Asian students who are underrepresented as people who can get into colleges relative, say, to their SAT scores, GPAs, et cetera. Now, that doesn't automatically apply to public corporations, but there is a kind of tendency for these things to kind of move that way. So can you talk a little bit about that ruling and how it might end up affecting private businesses?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Supreme Court said that you've got to have, it's exceedingly rare under the Constitution and our laws more generally that it is appropriate for government actors to take people's race into account. And in lots of occasions, it's also going to be inappropriate for private actors to do that. And so these cases covered both public and private. You had University of North Carolina, which is a state university, of course, and Harvard, which, while private, is subject to the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which forbids race discrimination by recipients of federal financial assistance. And Harvard gets plenty of federal financial assistance, including but not limited to its students' eligibility for subsidized student loans and the like. So the court really rather thoroughly unpacks the lack of the impropriety of invoking the educational benefits of diversity as a racial kind of superficial skin color identity politics diversity as a basis for any kind of preferences on account of race. The interesting thing here, Jerry, is that I think a pretty good argument can be made that diversity on the basis of skin color, essentially, was already not a permitted reason to do DEI or race preferential treatment in the workplace, in the private sector workplace. I think the court's ruling removes any, in my mind, any shadow of a doubt that wanting to have skin color diversity is somehow an appropriate thing for employers to have in mind when hiring, firing, promoting, demoting people on the basis of race.
I see. So how would that legally work its way out of public entities into private entities?
So
or how might it?
There are, even before this, but certainly it's been growing in recent months, there are a variety of organizations, I think both private law firms and not-for-profit organizations like America First Legal Group that we co-counsel with on some projects, have filed charges of discrimination by workers, job applicants or employees who've been the victim of discrimination at the hands, I think, typically of some like DEI program. And it could be race segregated trainings or race privileged promotion opportunities, all kinds of stuff like that. And I think what you would find when some of that stuff takes a little while to make its way through the pipeline with the EEOC prior to litigation. But when that gets to litigation, I think you're going to see a lot of language from the SFFA decision from the Supreme Court make its way into the legal filings of the challengers who are going to take You know, you could do something like take what the company has said, like, hey, we are giving these race preferences because we believe that diversity is our strength. And then compare that to what the Supreme Court has said about the impropriety of, you know, what the Chief Justice says about, like, the way to get rid of race discrimination is to get rid of all of it. I think that'll be very powerful.
I see. So there's a certain philosophical rebuttal. The Supreme Court has a certain sway. People call this the regime effect. When it says that there shouldn't be any discrimination based on race in any way, it's hard for them to argue diversity is their strength. But it also might be that having defined this kind of discrimination in public entities as, is there a term of art, pernicious discrimination or?
Invidious.
Invidious, that's it. Mm-hmm. Okay. If it's invidious discrimination, it seems to me that that strengthens the claim even outside public entities or directly publicly. Is that the point?
I mean, yeah, that's a big part of it. And you have, you're going to have, the Supreme Court has sent a very clear signal that I think will give a lot more people who've been victimized, who've been marginalized by the DEI regime, give them greater comfort in coming forward and knowing they've got a real chance of having their cases heard. So that there's some technical sense in which the lay of the land has not changed. Like it was already quite favorable to challenges to DEI programs that embody race preferences. But practically, I think this is a strong signal that the courts need to take this seriously.
Yeah. And you know, this is, again, an argument that I've made with the ESG world and the proxy people, that if you say to a company, we don't want you to discriminate based on race, and the company says, oh, don't worry about it, we don't, take our word for it, no proxy service or ESG shop would say, thanks for telling us that you don't discriminate based on race, you're okay. Mm-hmm. But when a proposal is put forward that says, we want you to talk about whether you reverse discriminate, the typical rebuttal is, well, they've already disclosed that they don't discriminate. So take their word for it. You know, I mean, come on, they're business people. They know what they're doing. So that's really interesting. So is this a situation where maybe floodgates are going to be opening or maybe not like right away? But it seems to me like this can have really big downstream implications.
I think it's going to build. And I think it's going to build in part because more people, there's more of an infrastructure coming online to help people deal with these kinds of cases. Like historically, a lot of people with who might want to bring I guess long story short, I think there's a lot more interest in this space, and I think you'll see both people being willing to come forward and also a greater number and cadre of attorneys who are ready, willing, and able to help them with those.
All right. Jonathan Berry, managing partner of Boyden Gray, a relatively new post. I note with sadness the passing of your founder, a man of very great stature.
God rest his soul.
God rest his soul indeed. And all of ours when the time comes. But, you know, he seems to have a successor who is ready to play the role and to continue that vision and, by God's grace, perhaps expand it. Anything else, Jonathan, you want to mention to us before we go?
I would just like to give people, give your listeners, Jerry, a note of encouragement that I think the effort to educate corporate America that they should not be taking ordinary Americans for granted, as they so often are, I think that season is coming to an end, and it's coming to an end because a lot more people are willing to stand up and make their voices heard. And so I'm very grateful for that. And I'm glad to be doing my small part to help advance that cause.
They're attending meetings, they're starting to do proposals, and some of them are actually stepping up and becoming litigants, which is an extremely powerful tool. But of course, people need to be willing to be litigants, right? It takes a little bit of courage.
It does.
Even if the risk is low, nevertheless, just putting your name out there takes a little bit of courage. But what are we going to do? Let our country continue to sink into that cesspool? Or are we going to be able to tell future generations we stood up and, like the signers of the Declaration, we put our names on the line and signed them, you know, in big letters for George III to see?
That's right.
All right, Jonathan Barry from Boyd & Gray. Can we have you back in a little while to talk about some of the other things you're working on? Would you be willing to come back?
Absolutely, Jerry. Love to do it.
I'm Jerry Boyer. This is Meeting of Minds podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.